Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Big Hunker Podcast.
What about kids of all ages?
I don't know if it's appropriate that they're listening to our show.
Do you let your son, my grandson, oldest one, will listen to it?
No way.
It's pretty good. Probably a pretty good deal.
But, I mean, honestly, I don't know.
He's pretty level-headed, though.
He's probably heard most of it out here.
Yeah, this is not really a good place to raise kids. Look how y'all all turned out.
That's right.
Next thing you know, you wake up and he'll be in the hunting business.
Oof. God, I hope not. Check us out. We're up on YouTube now. All episodes, all new episodes are going up to YouTube. We Skype our guests. It all goes up to the YouTube machine. So if you're bored, check us out on YouTube. Big Hunker Podcast. Pretty easy to find. This podcast is brought to you by the one and only Stanfield Hunting Outfitters. Got a couple turkey hunts left.
Got a couple turkey hunts left. I got one dove hunt, private dove hunting weekend left for 20 or more. And that's about it. And I've got some October hunts and some November hunts.
A little bit of here and there.
All because two fat boys had a dream.
A little bit of here and there. So call Jeff, 940-658-3172 if you think you want to come out.
And I do answer my own phone. I'm unlike that world-famous Andy Shaver.
Yeah.
Just old fucking Jeff answers his phone.
So, got to.
Yep.
We're also brought to you by Blindgrass. Listen, they're not just a company that sells synthetic grass for your blind, but they do sell synthetic grass for your blind, and it works great. You brush it once, you forget about it, it's not going to rot or mildew. But they also have waterproof gun cases and waterproof shell bags. If you're somebody that hunts water, listen, we're waterfowlers, or if you're hunting flooded timber and you're worried about your shotgun shells, taking a dive.
Or you're on a boat all summer fishing. If you've got a boat, get one of their dry bags, put your stuff in it, seal it up in that bag and leave it in your boat, and you don't have to worry. Because trust me, when that something happens to that boat and you wish you had a dry bag, it's too late.
Beautiful. Blindgrass.com. Also, we are brought to you by Bangtail Whiskey at Bangtail.com.
Traditional corn mash whiskey, aged in charred new American oak barrels. You'll find a pleasant aroma of vanilla and spice before galloping to notes of nougat, sweet corn, and a lingering caramel finish. Whiskey's made right there in Florida. Good friend Brandon Bean, up-and-coming country singer. It's his stuff. It's Bangtail Whiskey, and you can get that at Bangtail.com.
Yeah, they'll ship it right to you, right?
Yeah, you can go up to they ship it anywhere in the United States now. You can buy it online, ship to your door, make you an old-fashioned.
A whiskey sour, Jeff.
Is that what you make?
That's what all the proper gentlemen are drinking, are whiskey sour.
Oh, excuse me. I'm not proper. And I guess I'm not a gentleman.
You know, people, that's the first thing they think of. Check them out at bangtail.com. It is good whiskey. We had it out here this last winter. Really good stuff. We're also brought to you by Goose Creek Retriever, Mr. Matt Peel. It is the dog training season. If you're going to have your four-legged buddy ready to go by September, October, November, you need to get on the horse right now, and Matt Peel can help you out.
At GooseCreekRetrievers.com, they have an early exposure puppy program. It's 10 weeks to 5 months old. If you're going to spend the money to buy a dog to train, there's no sense, and I've seen so many people do it. They buy a puppy, and it sits in their kennel till 6 months old.
Yeah.
Or they sit at the house, your kids ruin the dog basically by spoiling it, and then you got to start all over. Send it off to somewhere like Matt. Have them take that puppy from 10 weeks on and get it started and ready. They're going to get exposure to live birds, dead birds, water, gunfire, obedience, and potty training. And potty training's the key. If you buy a dog, you send your puppy off, and the sumbitch don't shit in the house. So I'm telling you right now, GooseCreekRetrievers.com, our buddy Matt Peel, and get the early exposure puppy program and tell him just plain old Jeff told you to give him a call.
Because plain old Jeff will be sending his dog to Goose Creek Retrievers.
Oh, I am not training a dog to potty train.
And if you've got that four-legged friend, then you're going to need stuff to go around it. You need to go to gundogoutdoors.com and get their stuff that's going to help you make life a little bit better around the house for your four-legged hunting buddy. They've got the field trauma kit, which I think everybody needs, whether you got a dog or not. They've got this nifty little water gadget. You press a button, water comes out into the little mouth guard. Dog drinks it that way. No more cramming water bottles down your dog's throat. It's easy. and effective. And also, they've got what I think is the best product since sliced bread, the quick release system. It is now patented. All it takes is one accident. All it takes is one dog breaking, and it's a completely different morning. Get the quick release system. Keep your four-legged hunting buddy right next to you where he should be. We're also brought to you by Pacific Calls. The boys up at Pacific Calls have a hell of a thing going on. They're retooling the 206. I've had the pleasure of running it. It is an absolute screamer. It's also turkey season. They've got mouth calls. They've got some pot calls. You can check them out at PacificCustomCalls.com. And if you use the promo code BHP25, it saves you 25% off at checkout.
They're going to be at Squad Fest.
Yep.
And they're going to be at the Ducks Unlimited at Texas Motor Speedway in June. And then they'll be at the Game Fair in Minnesota.
They better get to going.
And
they better get to building.
And the world-famous Andy Shaver is going to be at Squad Fest and at Anoka, Minnesota.
So we're still negotiating, but we'll see.
You're negotiating on what?
We're negotiating, Jeff.
Who's we?
It was a joke. You didn't. Oh. You obviously didn't get it.
I guess not.
Check them out, PacificCustomCalls.com. Speaking of Squad Fest, we're
brought to you by... negotiating on rights of having to sign autographs all day. Excuse us.
I'm not signing autographs all day.
But you will if someone asks you.
We'll see. Once again, we're negotiating. We're brought to you by Dive Bomb Industries, the leader. Skinny is the way to go. Oh, we packed everything up just a couple months ago. Everything's stored away so nicely. It's insane. You need to be running silhouettes. The full body movement is over. It's done with. DiveBombIndustries.com. It's a way of life. You get skinny, you put out big spreads, you pack them up nice and neat, and you move on about your day.
Organized and life is simple.
I love it. They've also got they got some new floaters coming out. Be looking for they've got the duck floater out already, but they've also got Canada Goose floater coming out in the near future. So be looking for that over at DiveBombIndustries.com. Love them. Also, we're brought to you by Dirty Duck Coffee. If your coffee sucks, it ain't the duck. Texas made. It's how I start my morning every morning with the high velocity. Fill that cup up and away I go. It's my go-go juice.
And look at their swag. They got a brand new t-shirt coming out that is badass.
Am I going to get one, Jeff, or am I going to have to
They got our sizes. They got a badass shirt coming that I don't think they've got up on the site, but I've seen it, and it's awesome. So
see, and, you know, Jeff says I'm world famous, but he's getting insider information. But, dude, check them out at dirtyduckcoffee.com and get your high velocity or – they've got a bunch of different blends, so check them out. Whichever one fits your personality, buy it. Dirty Duck Coffee. Also brought to you by Boss Shot Shells, American-made, bismuth copper-plated. All it takes is one. They're running their Boss Tom line right now. I am very much looking forward to smacking a Tom turkey in the face with Boss Tom.
You still giving everybody one Boss Tom to shoot the turkey with this year? Or is that last year's deal?
That was last year's deal, Jeff. Corona screwed that for everybody. We'll see. But no, that was last year. You're screwed. Check them out, BossShotShells.com. It's never too early to get your shotgun shells for this coming season.
Highly recommend getting your shells. Get them ordered before summertime.
Do not wait until the last minute is what we're trying to say. So
last year at the end of the year, I had guys calling me every day that were coming on a hunt. Hey, we'll be there next week. We're having trouble finding shells. Don't get stuck in that situation. Start stocking up now. Buy a case now, buy another case in May, buy a case in July, and you're done for the year.
BossShotShells.com. We're also brought to you by Lucky Duck. It is predator hunting season. There are tournaments all over. They have a wonderful electronic predator call. You make all sorts of noises with it. Clay Reed would approve.
Best blinds on the market?
Best blinds on the market, best spinners on the market, bar none. You can fit four grown men in the blind. And
don't forget about your buddy that rides in the back of the truck and get you a dog crate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They've got a dog crate out there that is 5-star crash test rated or whatever they stick with it. So don't worry about sticking Fido in the back of the pickup, because if he blows out, he'll be okay. Or if, hit a patch of ice, he'll be all right back there. You, maybe not so much. Dog will make it. Check him out, luckyduck.com. Last but not least, RIP, rest in paradise, Looking Glass Duck Club podcast.
Might be coming back soon.
I might have some information. You're terrible to these people.
Anyways, check them out at the Looking Glass
Duck Club. They still have, you can still support them. They have apparel. You can check him out on Instagram and message Logan. He really likes penis pictures. So just if you send him a penis picture, you get like a free koozie or something like that. So he loves to see it. Check him out, lookingglassduckclub.com or lookingglassduckclub on Instagram. And enjoy. We appreciate everybody listening. Check us out on YouTube. Subscribe if you haven't already. That's what everybody on YouTube has to say. Like and subscribe. All right, this episode of the podcast, we are joined by the one and only Mr. Ramsey Russell. He is a world traveler, even during COVID times. Didn't really put a damper on his style. He still traveled plenty, still pulled the trigger a lot. He's a very, very interesting man, and we had a great conversation with him. So we hope that you enjoy it. He's also got a podcast out called It's Duck Season Somewhere. You can check him out wherever you're listening to this one. Here he is, Ramsey Russell. Go in 3, 2, 1.
Boom, and welcome to the Big Honker Podcast brought to you by Bangtail Whiskey. I'm Jeff Stanfield.
I am Andy Shaver, and we have got the one and only, the world traveler, even in COVID times, Mr. Ramsey Russell. How are you, Ramsey?
I'm good, man. Double R, Ramsey Russell.
That's it.
I'm in Mississippi right now.
Well, you know, I don't imagine it's as pretty as where you were last week. Weren't you? You were in Mexico last week, weren't you? Or was that two weeks ago?
It's been a couple of weeks, but yeah, I was in Mexico a couple of weeks ago, and I miss it. I love Mexico. I love it. I love Western Mexico, I should say, and Eastern Mexico. I don't care much for Central Mexico, but I like the ends.
Now, how was it traveling this year with COVID, with everything that we've gone through? How was it compared to normal years?
Man, I'm glad you asked that because I ain't going to lie to you, man. It was, since COVID stuck a big old stick in everybody's gears, you know, haven't been no international travel. Now, look, I'll back up and say this. I got home on February 22nd or 23rd, 2020 from Azerbaijan and was going to be home for 2 straight months, 60 days. And that would have been the longest consecutive stretch of time I've been home in 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. My old lady and I, we went down to Dallas, my wife, I should say, because she's nearby.
Yeah.
We went down to Dallas and saw the Eagles. And, man, what a great concert and a great time. And I never forget, because it was all guys our age, my age, you know, sitting up in there. It was all couples, and we were all, man, you know, concerts have changed a lot since I had hair and went to them regularly. You know, you don't smoke nothing in a concert now, but but you buy liquor. And, man, what a great time that turned out to be. But and Eagles put on just a heck of a show. Man, what a heck of a show. But I never will forget, we were all up talking to, you know, all the folks around us, you know. Oh, man, don't cough on me unless you take a swig of that vodka. You know, I don't want no COVID. And never dreaming in a million years what's fixing to come down the pipe. And, whew, but anyway, I traveled a lot in the States this year. And when I went to Mexico, I have to admit, I was a little nervous because it's a foreign country. And, you know, I love Mexico, but doesn't have a $12.5 trillion economy. It's not America. It's not the greatest country in the world in that respect. And having to wear a mask, and everybody in the airport's wearing a mask, and it's so weird flying because you got a social distance and all this kind of mess, and the restaurants and anywhere to eat inside an airport are closed, but then you're packed like sardines on a plane, or packed like sardines neck to neck, you know, in the waiting rooms or whatever. And we, the minute I stepped out of that Mazatlan airport into the sunshine and took my mask off, it started feeling normal. And by the time we got to the resort and I was halfway through my first margarita, I had just about forgotten all about COVID. And the most shocking thing, Jeff, is all the, you know, having been to California and Michigan and a lot of these blue states that are handling COVID in a ridiculous way, I think, shutting it down and trying to crash the economy. I show up in Mexico and everything's open. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the airports you walk through down there, you kind of go through this little mister. And when you're coming through customs, they stop you and they take your temperature. And when you come into the hotel, they take your temperature and some smiling face, put some hand sanitizer out, and you step on this little doormat that cleans your shoes and they check your temperature. And you walk inside and you look around and go, well, nobody's got the flu and everybody's got clean hands and clean shoes and no cooties, you know. And because you have to take that COVID test to come back in the States a few days later, by day two or three, you're sitting out there in the field and you're like, I know you sons of bitches ain't got COVID because I don't either. And but why isn't our country doing just basic little safety protocols? Why aren't we doing that? Right. Because I felt so safe and so normal, and I really felt normal when I stepped out on the water bank, started shooting ducks like that, you know, unpressured ducks. It felt so normal. It felt good. It felt so good. And then a few weeks later, going down to Obregon for a couple of weeks stretch, same thing. It just clean as a whistle. And, of course, the staff wore masks and stuff like that. But we're spending most of our days out in the field or outside, so we don't need a mask. It was just awesome. And I'll say this. We had once I got back in late January, our phone blew up. It melted with people wanting to go to Mexico. And I mean right now, like I want to go next week if you got availability. And we sold the joints out for the remainder of the season. And so hundreds upon hundreds of people went to three different destinations down in Mexico. Not one person came back with COVID. Not one person got stuck. Everybody just went and had a great time. And believe it or not, 2022 is nearly completely sold out. Sold out in one destination, nearly in another, and 2023 is filling up quick because, man, look, people are ready to get the hell out and go have fun again.
People are tired of it. I noticed that all during hunting season.
No.
Let's about face now to America, because one of the big debates right now, and we get caught up in this every other year, is the flooded corn. Now, flooded corn, some people are saying, making the ducks go nocturnal. Now, I had a message today from a guy that hunts in Nebraska. And me and you were on the same forum yesterday. I don't remember where we were at. I don't know if it was on my page, Dive Bomb's page, or whose page. But someone brought up the duck hunt. I think it might have been ours.
It was ours.
And I said something. The guy today messaged me, and he said, you know, Jeff, he said, I've hunted on the Platte River for 20 years. He said, about 10 to 15 years ago, people started field hunting. And he said, before that, you didn't see very many people field hunting ducks. And he said, since they've started field hunting ducks, those ducks used to stay on the water and they would go out and feed in the fields, come back in the river, and people would shoot at them. He said, since they've started shooting them in the fields all the time and the flooded corn, those ducks don't leave water off that river until 15 minutes before dark. What's your thoughts on this?
Well, is it field hunting or is it cornfields or is it something else?
No, they're hunting cornfields.
That well, I'm making a point right here because I hear cornfields being beat up. We need to quit doing cornfields, and I disagree. It's one man's opinion, and I'll tell you why. Or now, 20 years ago, we didn't hunt cornfields. Now we're hunting dry fields. Maybe that's it. But I think it all boils down to the same thing, and I believe that. Okay, I listened to Chose the other day on y'all's podcast, and y'all were talking about cornfields and talking about those birds flying in that cornfield and huddling up till pitch black dark and then flying out 5 minutes before day and coming back right 5 minutes before shooting time. Mm-hmm. So is it cornfields? I don't think so. I don't think so, Jeff. And I believe if you got rid of corn and put standing coffee weed out in there, it'd be the same thing. Now, consider this, for example. How big is that cornfield? 40 acres? That's a quarter mile. That's a quarter mile by a quarter mile. Is it 640 acres of a section? Well, that's a mile by a mile. And I've got a blind out there. How far am I shooting? If I'm shooting 40 yards on average, a 40 yard radius, well, I'm a dumb forester, but I can do the math of area of a circle. I'm covering an acre out of 40 or an acre out of 640 acres. And if you've ever hunted cornfields, and I have, those ducks land all which way. They land anywhere they want to, and they're safe. And maybe they're eating that corn if they can access it. But they're safe, and there's a thermal barrier, there's a habitat value, but really it's safety. And here's what I'm going to tell you this story. and I'm dumb as a brick. I'm a functional wildlife biologist, and I don't know how I got out of school because they're technical fields, and I don't really do math. Statistics ain't math. Statistics, I understood. Math, I don't understand. And but I never, ever will forget. Here's what I'm getting at. Long answer, but here's what I'm getting at about cornfields, about hunting fields. I'm very adamant about what I believe the problem is in America. And I'm going to use this example. I'm going to use a story from way back in college. I had this wildlife professor, and he was a biometrician of epic proportion, like a lot of those real PhD biologists are, man. They know statistics, man. And I never forget this work problem we had to do. He was talking about cause and effect, regression analysis. And we had to go home and run through this problem he gave us. But it kind of went like this. As Baptist churches increase in a community, murders increase. And the numbers don't lie.
That's true.
So what should we do? So what should we do, Jeff? Should we go out and do away with all the First Baptist churches in America? But if you went and did his math, what you realized is there was all kinds of data on that problem he gave us. It was churches. And that's kind of where he left it when we left the classroom, was the more churches there are, the higher the murder is. Well, then you started noticing on the data, the more telephone poles you had, and then you started noticing the bigger the population, and the answer he was looking for was as population density increases, murders increase. Well, the more people you got, the more churches you got. Get it?
Right.
And so it can be misleading, you know, and I understand that we see these ducks flying into cornfields and staying the day because they're safe, they're out of the wind, they're out of the sunshine, they've got a thermal barrier, they've got a food source. And most importantly, in a 40-acre field, quarter mile by quarter mile, I'm not covering but an acre of it with my shotgun. You know, unless I'm that Raining Bands guy. Now he's covering 2 acres, but I'm covering an acre. And my point being is 20 years ago, not only were we maybe not dry field hunting, we weren't riding these loud ATVs and these loud surface motors. There were vast tracts of property that we couldn't access and didn't access. My God, I was smiling like a kid that just won the World Series Little League baseball game when I got a 185 three-wheeler back in the day, and that was a big dog. Now look at what we got, 1,000 horsepower, lift kits and tracks, and it'll go anywhere. Jeff, we got too goddamn much pressure on these ducks in America. And I go down to Mexico, I go down to Mazatlan, and the magic is not Mexico. The magic is we're going out, man, one of the coolest mornings we had this year because it was dry in Mazatlan. It was dry. So we went to this area we call the moon. In a normal wet year, it's a massive ankle-deep mud flat, soupy mud as far as you can see, and this little freshwater channel comes into it. We walk about 100 yards through soupy mud, about ankle-deep, getting blinds, and 8 of us shoot 160 ducks, and we're done. This year, all that was gone. The moonscape was gone. We were down to the little feeder creek, and I shit you not, it was 20 feet wide. I stepped it off. It was 20 feet wide. Not 20 yards, 20 feet, and it was 200 yards long. We're talking a surface acre of water along this, for lack of a better word, ditch. We're talking surface acres of a quarter acre. And me and Mr. Ian got in one blind, and 50 yards down the bank, a husband-wife team got in another, and in an hour and a half, we shot 80 ducks, 20 apiece, mm-hmm. Quick as you could. Brrr, done. And you know what? That hole did not get shot again for 7 or 8 days at all. At all, Jeff. It was like... You were talking about this the other day. How many outfitters do you have within 50 or 100 miles of you?
We don't have a lot here, but if you
hundred miles, 100 miles,
Oklahoma, Texas, yeah. Other yeah. parts of Texas.
Yes, there's tons now. Especially the Lubbock area alone, there's probably 30 outfitters that are running out of Lubbock, from a mom and pop deal to somebody that runs 2-3 groups a day. But I would bet around Lubbock, within 50 miles of Lubbock, you could probably find 30 groups of hunters every day.
All right. Hold this thought. I'm working for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service right out of college before I found religion. And all I wanted to do in high school and college was wear a brown uniform and make the world a better place. federal government was not my calling. But I worked in refuges, and I did love it for 3 years. And I never forget, we had a biologist who was a shorebird guy. And he would pawn off as much waterfowl responsibility onto the forester, me, as he could because I loved ducks. I flew aerial surveys and did a lot of that stuff when I could. But he come in there and knocked on my door one day, and he says, Ducks Unlimited biologist had called him, and on the north end of one of our sanctuaries, our refuge, on the north end of one of our refuges was an inviolate sanctuary, and in there, roosting every night, were three radio-collared hens. And now, that was back in the late 90s, and I would have thought, with all the beans and rice and flooded ag and moist soil in Bolivar County, Mississippi, I would have thought that those ducks were coming off that roost and were going to be killed within 3 or 4 or 5 miles. Doesn't that make sense? Yeah. In 3 or 4 or 5 miles, they're going to hit one of these fields. And boy, I hunted those areas. Never saw them. Well, 11 miles due west of that sanctuary was the Mississippi River. Across the Mississippi River was right where the White River dumped into that, into the Mississippi River. And every one of that cohort died in a rice field in Stuttgart, Arkansas, 45 miles away. And that changed everything I thought about a wild duck. Those ducks were roosting in a sanctuary and flying 45 miles to feed. Over how much habitat? No, right. No, it didn't matter. They were going where they wanted to go, or they were going where they were had a phylopatric tendency to go, that where they were imprinted to go. And that just changed everything I thought. So now, get up there in that Texas Panhandle or one of them parts of the country you're talking about where you've got all these outfitters spread out at 50, 60, 70 miles, man, they're hunting the same freaking birds over and over and over and over, let alone the mom and pops and everybody else is just out there hunting. It's too much pressure, I believe, on these ducks, Jeff. I believe, and I don't know what the answer is. My God, I'm hunting a bunch.
Right.
And I want everybody to hunt a bunch, and I think we need more hunters. But interestingly enough, the more you get outside your backyard, the more you see. Right about the time you think you've seen and done it all, you see something else. When you go out there to the state of Utah, nearly every single club in the Bear River Valley and on the south end, on the north end, and then on the south end, all those clubs around the Great Salt Lake, nearly every single one of them, only shoot a few days, but all of them have a sanctuary. All of the state properties have a sanctuary. All of the federal properties have a sanctuary. And then when you get out on the Great Salt Lake itself, and those green wings and golden eyes and shovelers are out there feeding in the salt water on brine larvae and brine larvae eggs, or brine shrimp egg and brine shrimp larvae, it's just miles upon miles upon miles of sheep water that you can hunt here, and they can go land 200, 300, 500 yards away, a mile away, and nobody's disturbing them. They've got somewhere to go. And I just argue my thoughts, and hey, just one man's opinion, my thoughts are the reason we're seeing those birds use that corn is not because of corn. It's because of hunting pressure adjacent to it. And the truth of the matter is, you know, I hear these guys saying, well, we need to open up all the refuges. Screw you. Man, a duck has got to have somewhere to go.
Right.
You know,
right.
Al Afton, 20 years ago, Al Afton down at LSU was showing where the pintail and the bluebills and other ducks were rafting 30 miles offshore of Louisiana just to find somewhere they weren't disturbed. You know, I know the numbers, the data, the hunting data shows that hunter numbers are going down, but by the same token, the amount of huntable area is being distilled into a much smaller amount of area. You know, two, 3 years ago over in northeast Louisiana, I can't remember the name of that parish right now, over 65 pit blinds have been pulled out. Well, that's 65 fewer places to hunt. Those farmers are now, they find they can make $150,000, $200,000 more by not putting water on their site, by not letting soil compaction occur with the water on it, not waiting till spring to start disking and chisel plowing their soil and getting that hard pen out. Hey, I can disc it up right now, go to market and lock my seeds, my crop in sooner and make $150,000. So who cares about this $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 cash I'm making off of duck hunters? I can make 3 or 4 times that by farming better.
What about
it's less and less and less and less habitat, and the quality of habitat, Jeff. You know, back 20, 30 years ago, look at the rice crops we had. There wasn't Clearfield rice. There wasn't Roundup Ready rice. There wasn't third and fourth generation soybeans that in 20 or 30 days with a little soil moisture rot, you know, and offer no nutritive value. And for that matter, go just look up on the Arkansas prairie. There weren't hundreds of thousands of snow geese hitting the rice fields and getting what little rice is left over with the modern day combining practices. I think it's a habitat quality, a habitat abundance, and a hunting pressure quotient that's going into some of the problems we're experiencing in waterfowl, not just in the deep south, but nationwide.
So the big argument is that flooded corn, the ducks are getting more nocturnal. And they're not, and I'm not talking about the migration deal because we hadn't had no winter, and that's what's going to dictate your migration anyways, is going to be winter. On the pressure deal, a goose has, like where we hunt out here, the roost lakes don't get jacked with much. Those geese get somewhere to roost. Nobody screws with them on water. They only get hunted in the fields. So half of their situation, they're not getting jacked with. These ducks, they get it on the water and in the field. And I live in a place with no refuges, so I'm not dealing with all that. But I have noticed in the last couple of years, more and more people are talking about the mallards are getting more and more nocturnal, and it is probably it's going to be pressure related. But
that
it's not
about cornfields. It's like on our property down in the South Delta, Mississippi, which is mediocre duck hunting in the best of years. If we don't get out there with 2-4-D, we go out there and we do a lot of disking and water management as we can to promote desirable grasses and broadleaves. If it gets away from us, we get a bunch of coffee weed. And the same thing happens. It's a worthless habitat, except that because the ducks are having hunting pressure, they get in there and we can't hunt them. So we go in and we spray and we patch it up. And now we take a 40-acre hole that we can't hunt, but the areas that are clear, if we let the coffee weed get away from us, there's no nutritive value in coffee weed. Or we go out there and manage it to where we can access the whole 40 acres and hunt those ducks. And what we see, the ducks aren't really coming on us to feed. They're coming in. If you want to shoot mallards, when the mallards are in our part of the Delta, you generally need to stay out there past 9 o'clock, from 9 to noon, 9 to 1, and they're coming in pairs and small groups. You know, is when we're getting them, and we're just having to be patient and wait them out.
I don't think we're going to see duck hunting.
I don't believe in outlawing corn. I don't believe that the cornfield is what's holding them up. I believe you're seeing a cause and effect. They're finding value in a wide open or a wide spanse of structure, vertical structure that does have some feed, and they're finding sanctuary in there is why. And I think they're responding nocturnally because of hunting pressure, you know, because of all the modern convenience and the modern implementation of man, you know, as someone that's traveled 6 continents duck hunting, we Americans have elevated duck hunting to art form. The camo, the ammo, the chokes, the guns, the machinery, the boats, the motors, the fully fuzzed decoys. We're killers. Mm-hmm. And the best duck hunters you're going to find elsewhere are going to be an emulation of Americans at best. I mean, you know, we hunt and we're passionate about it, man. We don't go out like my granddad did. My granddad was a duck hunter. And he went out 12 days, maybe a year. He didn't take off work and take vacation and skip business meetings and conferences to go shoot ducks. That was what he did in his off time. Well, man, you know, we all take off Christmas break and skip basketball games and everything else to get after these ducks. You know, there's just too dang much hunting pressure. What are you going to do? I don't know.
Well, that kind of my next or a question. What are some things that you think could improve our current situation without giving up too much? I mean, and that's another thing. You know, this is an American pastime.
If you can't have spatial sanctuary, like I went out there and hunted with a buddy, John Wills, in California for about, I think we hunted 12 days. We jumped all over the Sacramento Valley, the grasslands, just, Lord have mercy, the thousands of miles I put in 12 days up and down Highway 99. Public, private, you name it. Marshes, rice fields, and one thing is we were setting up these dates and I started threading together these hunts. John said, well, the hard problem is going to be working around shoot days. And I did not understand what he meant until we started threading these hunt together. And like, you know, they've got a 107-day season in the Pacific Flyway, but none of those state WMAs are shooting 107 days. You shoot on Wednesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Mm-hmm. And trust you me, on Sundays, every duck coming in probably done been shot at on Saturday. And likewise, a lot of the clubs out there, same thing could be said about some of those clubs in Utah. They're only shooting 2 or 3 days a week. And, you know, so they're affording, not only might they have spatial sanctuary, a geographic area that those ducks can go and not be shot at, but they have temporal space, sanctuary, long periods of time that the ducks can get in to do ducky things and imprint on that property and continue to use that property. And so when the weather's right and the stars line up, you can go out there and shoot them. And I think there's a lot of value in that. Now, you know, wow, with what it costs to hunt at a club member or a lease or something like that, how do you, or if you've got an outfitter and you've got 60 days booked with clients coming in and out, how do you do that? I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's, you know, I look at our situation here and we've got November, December, and January.
Yeah.
You got to make money. And I mean, you know, it sounds bad, but you want to compact everything into that narrow time frame. But then you got to look at kind of what you're doing to your resource.
We're going to take off a day here next year, though. We're going to take off a Wednesday about every 2 weeks just so we can have a freaking day off. That's it. Just for that reason only. Not because I'm worried about bird pressure, because we don't put a lot of pressure on our birds compared to a lot of places. We're pretty lucky here. But just so we can have a damn day off. But the ducks, when I first got into business, there wasn't a lot of outfitters. There was very few outfitters, to be honest with you. There was a lot of deer outfitters in Texas, but there wasn't very many waterfowl guys. There damn sure wasn't very many people running an operation like we run now. And you could go from Knox City, Texas, to the Canada border, and the only pressure them birds got put on was the first couple of weeks in Canada when the Americans would go to Canada. Even back in the early 90s, there wasn't a lot of guys that went to Canada. There were people up there, but now the birds get pressured from September 1st until the last day of dark season.
That's right.
I mean, that's the honest to God deal. I don't think anybody wants to outlaw corn. I think a lot of people want to see them putting water on corn. I don't have an issue with them putting water on corn, but I don't understand why it's illegal for someone to go plant a cornfield and thrash it. It's the same to me. It's the same principle. It's
yeah, I didn't know it was legal to do that.
It's not. You have to leave it standing.
You have to leave it standing and flood it. That's legal. You can't thrash it. But I don't understand if you're going to let someone flood a cornfield, a field that's not been picked, and you're going to let them flood it. I don't understand why it's illegal to have a field and just shred it. I mean, you're still doing.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I don't understand why that it's illegal to do that if you're going to let them flood it. It's the same thing.
The normal farming practices is what confuses me. Like, you're telling me that planting a field and then flooding it with water, that's a normal farming practice? That's the loophole we're going to go through?
There's nothing normal about that.
Well, I've said this for a very long time. I've just, you know, the more you live, the more you learn. I've seen where my favorite places worldwide to shoot ducks are not agriculture at all, flooded or otherwise. It's boring hunting an agricultural landscape to me. I would much rather be in a natural marsh or just a natural habitat. You know, some of the places Chokes and I have hunted together, some of the places I've seen around the world where those places still exist, you know, these vibrant wetlands that don't have any agriculture. And it's very rewarding to get off into a very natural environment. There's plenty of good habitat for ducks. You know, we got to feed the world here in America, so no day to pass. I'm not saying I don't like farming or believe in farming or support farmers. I'm just saying I do like to hunt natural areas, good, vibrant, healthy wetlands. And over at our own place, we find a lot of value in cultivating natural moist soil plants. You know, just smart weeds and sedges and grasses and things of that nature. We find a lot of habitat value and a lot of waterfowl utilization when we hit it right. The ducks come down.
What about this, Ramsey? And a guy made a point to this that messaged me, and he goes, Jeff, he said, I'm a working guy. I've got a family. He said, my hunting is my hobby, but I can't afford to put a lot of money into it. I've got to send kids to college and stuff. He goes, flooded corn is a rich man's deal that the poor man can't do. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of point there. That's a very good point.
But you can't penalize a man, Jeff, for having saved money and spending how he wants.
No. I don't have a problem with him even doing it. I don't care if you flood corn. I don't. I do not have any problem with that at all. But I see where this man, his outlook is, it's just for rich guys only. But I think if you're going to let people flood corn, I don't understand what the hell. Because when you bait, you're not helping just a few ducks that get shot. If you have a field, 160-acre field, and you flood 160 acres of corn, and you kill 1,000 ducks on it this year, but you feed 30,000 ducks, well, you've done a great service for them other ducks and all the other things that are there. But you ought to be able to take 160 acres and shred corn and do something else to bait your field. Because that's all you're doing. You're hunting over a baited field.
Well, corn is a grass. Japanese millet is a grass. Barnyard grass is a grass. What's the difference? Flooded grass is flooded grass, I'd argue.
Well, right. that's a really good point. I never have thought of it that way. But can you shred that millet down? The second year you can.
No.
I thought on the second year you could. The first year you couldn't. I thought the second year
you could. If it's naturally established, you know, you can go in there and mow it and shred it. But,
okay.
Not if it's been planted that year.
But you got to wait a year to do it.
Yep. And we only mow a natural grass, a sprangle tops or barnyard grass or whatever have you like that. We only mow enough to float the decoys. You know, we leave the rest standing when possible or roll it down or something just because, you know, it's like all the, God, it seems like millions of acres I've walked across mud flats spreading Jap millet. I've never killed a duck. I've never killed a duck with a craw full of Jap millet, you know. But I was talking to a buddy of mine that's got some old catfish ponds up in Belzoni, and all they do is mull soil and Jap millet. And I asked him, he's a veterinarian, and I asked him one time when I get my dog looked at, I said, you know, have you ever killed a duck slap full of Jap with a craw full of Jap millet? And he goes, no, I have not, but some college kids, a college program came down and was walking through his pond, sweeping with little butterfly looking nets and doing invertebrate biomass studies. And he said, and our Jap millet had the highest amount of invertebrates. And that's what those birds were in there doing. They weren't eating the seed off of Jap millet. They were utilizing that substrate, that deteriorating grass stalk, to get the invertebrates off, you know, whatever you want to call it, water bugs, arthropods, baby crawfish, fairy shrimp. You know, that's why they were in there.
Boy, this would have been a good year to have some winter to see if we would have got a push. I wish we'd have got this front we got in December to see.
Can you imagine? Well, you know, when that big ice hit the deep south on us, we've got a 20-acre fishing lake, average depth 6 foot, no habitat for ducks whatsoever. And somebody was over at camp, sent a picture. There were 6,000 mallards and pintails sitting on that ditch. That's the only place they had. And there were probably water bodies throughout the deep south with ducks holding out like that, just waiting. And, you know, it's like I told my son Forrest, there's probably some of those ducks that were down because of this cold weather were probably down for the first time in generations. Probably the first time in 3 or 4 generations they saw the deep south. I hope they remember it.
That's right.
I remember when I was his age, we used to get those clippers that would come down, and I was driving a little Toyota 4-cylinder at the time, and when those big clippers would come down, the first thing you did was find a piece of cardboard put between the grill and the radiator so you'd have heat in your truck, and your radiator wouldn't freeze, you know? And we had ducks back in those days.
Yeah, it's just when I first got in business, the winter that we had compared to today is just completely different. We have little days, but you could count on you was going to get 2 or 3 Alberta clippers every year. You were going to get some push of ducks, or you was going to get the weather, and we're not getting it now. But I really wish we'd have got that front early in the year to get those birds off of the flooded corn so the boys in Louisiana and them would see that it's more weather-related than it is food-related. There's corn everywhere now.
You know, I was talking to a waterfowl professor not too long ago. I've talked to several of them. A lot, you know, these telemetry studies are becoming big, and phylopatry is what they call a duck's relationship or fidelity for a certain piece of property. And like some of these spec studies, these female specs come off the Arctic and they fly down to Louisiana, and they don't just come to Louisiana, like they land on the exact same 40-acre rice field that that she always lands in. Year after year after, they're coming to a very precise place, and you start looking at some of their flight patterns. It looks like they've been shot from a bow and arrow. Straight as an arrow, they're flying, you know, to a certain little spot that's ducks, and you know, and then you don't see them during hunting season. But you go out after the season, first week of February, and there's ducks everywhere. Well, we need to open the season in February. No, the ducks have been there; they've just been hiding in sanctuaries. You know, one of the biologists was telling me about a Drake mallard that spent the entire duck season on three sanctuaries. He just went from one to the next to the next to the next. A week after duck season, he's covering the entire county. Wow. You know, and that to me is a function of hunting pressure. It's a function of hunting pressure. And I don't have the answer for it. I don't want to stop duck hunting no more than anybody else does, but it's something we've got to come to terms with. You know, we're wigging these birds out, man. And there's all kinds of, you know, I hunted this past season, just road tripping, hunted 21 states, all four flyways, tons of species, and it was everywhere. You know, it wasn't just Mississippi or Louisiana. It's everywhere, you know, nationwide. You're dealing with these problems here.
Everybody's saying the same thing everywhere you've been to.
Everywhere, you know. Now, let me throw this at you. I went to Delaware. I mean, you'd be shocked at the quality of hunting in places, the parts of Delaware. It was shocking. And I did hunt a cornfield. And for the life of me, I don't understand. I hunted one cornfield that was pretty productive. It had belt deep water, and the birds could access the corn if they wanted to. It was a tiny, tiny little corn planting. I went to another one. Man, those corns of ear were chest high. Mm-hmm. The water was let below your knees. I mean, a duck can't float like a hummingbird and peck the cob. You know, he might could jump up and get some. Most of the corn consumption I saw walking in off the ears were blackbirds and things of that nature had been pecking on it. But the area we hunted in front of the pit was just more soil. And that's where we were killing the birds, and it's more soil. But now, here's what I'm getting at about Delaware. It's Atlantic Flyway, and the limit is two mallards. And you know, you'll shoot a black duck or two, or some green-winged teal, maybe a shoveler. But I got to say, you know, coming out those days with a pair of mallards and maybe a black duck and a couple of teal, it felt like plenty. And, you know, it didn't take as long to shoot two mallards as it did four or five or six or seven. And so then again comes that temporal sanctuary, you know. And I mean, I was thinking to myself, man, for the quality of hunting, if I could go out and shoot two mallards a day, I would choose that in a heartbeat over some of the hunting I'm having to do. Y'all had Brian Huber on here not too long ago. And I met with Brian out in California, hunting wood ducks with him one morning. We got to talking about back in the day that the California speckle belly limit was two. You go out, bam, bam. It's just like shooting a pintail, one, bam, I'm done. You know, well, then the limit went to four. Would take, you know, on the best of days, it takes twice as long to shoot four as it does two. Well, now it's 10. Mm-hmm. And what's the mindset of a hunter? Stay till you get the limit.
Right.
And now you can't hardly shoot those specs because.
I think you touched on something there. I think limits. That should be something that we look at first before we start eliminating, you know, taking off days where you can't hunt or maybe restricting on fields that you can hunt. I think we should take a good hard look at how high some of these limits are. In Oklahoma, it's eight geese.
Eight Canadas, and then you can shoot two specks.
Right.
You can kill 10 freaking geese. That's ridiculous.
That's a bunch, you know, and I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. But, you know, my oldest son is 23 years old. And before he was born, let's say, what, it was 97, 98, they came out with this adaptive harvest management plan. And I remember the first year of the limit was 2 mallards in the Mississippi Flyway. It's been six ever since.
Right.
Six ducks, 4 mallards, ever since. His entire lifetime, all he's known is six ducks. And my question is, if the limit, you know, people say, well, duck hunting's not a numbers game. And maybe when you're old farts like me and you, Jeff, that have shot a bunch and done a bunch, maybe it's not. Maybe it is more of a quality experience than a numbers game. But like yourself, I shot a bunch of ducks back when I was young. It was a numbers game back when I was young. And I don't penalize somebody for getting new into it and not having, you know, it's a stage and a phase you go through. And they should want to do it. But it's a numbers game, too, because there is a limit. And, you know, to go out and play a hard game in duck hunting in a lot of places, especially in public land. Man, let me tell you what, those public land hunters out in California, hats off. Total respect. Those guys are among some of the best duck hunters I've seen if they're consistently bringing ducks out, because it's a hard hunt. And you go all in and you only kill three ducks. Well, it's like going to a movie, paying $20 to go see a movie and the projector breaking halfway through it. You feel cheated. You feel that I didn't measure up. I didn't get my limit. And I played a hard game, you know, and for a young guy or an average hunter, I get it. I was there when I was that age, you know, but if the limit was three or four, how would they feel? Would they be happy?
I got into the goose. That's how I got into goose hunting. I grew up duck hunting. And when I was a kid growing up, the limit was 10, or it was on a 100-point system. Our limit was 100 rounds of shells. Whatever we took 100 rounds out with us. Whenever we shot 100 rounds, we'd come home. If we shot 12 ducks or 63 ducks that morning, that's what our limit was. I didn't grow up in the right situation. I know it. But the times were, that was a different time in my life. But as a kid, that's what I was getting used to. Well, when they went from the point system, we went to three ducks. Well, I was probably 15, 16 years old, 17 years old. Well, shit, it wasn't no fun to shoot three ducks when you were used to going up and shooting 40, 50, and 60 in the morning. So I started goose hunting because the goose limit was the same thing. And then that's how we started goose hunting more than duck hunting. But I grew up duck hunting. But if I would have grown up and the limit was three, I would have still loved to duck hunt. But that mindset when I was a kid was that, hell, we could shoot 10 at one time. Now you can only shoot three. And you can shoot 10 pintails when I was growing up. And now you can shoot one. Now, I think the duck numbers are off. I don't think we have the ducks that they say we do, and I think we have more damn pintails than they say we do. But after talking to Brian, I think the problem is there's a lot more pintail drakes than there are pintail hens. So I've seen that
a lot. You know, Delta Waterfowl, Chris Nicolai at Delta Waterfowl was telling me Delta Waterfowl is proposing 30 years. We've been on restricted bag limit for pintails. And because of that skewed population you're talking about, you know, 6-1, 8-1 drakes per hen is putting undue pressure on those pintails. And he says that Delta Waterfowl advocates a modification to the pintail bag to be three pintail daily in the continental 48 states with one hen. But, you know, if I'm just having a great day and I say, you know what, I need my teeth kicked in, all I've got to do is post a limit of pintail drake from Mexico on the internet.
Yeah, no shit. I've seen them.
The limit is 15.
Yeah.
Well, that's absurd. We only kill one in California. But, you know, you can kill 8-10 in Alaska, 6-8 in Canada, 15 in Mexico, one in the continental U.S.
Right.
Well, something wrong.
Yeah, we
all know that it's not hunting pressure that's killing pintails. It's not those mean old American rich hunters down in Mexico shooting 15 a day. You know, there's more pintail killed opening weekend in California than is killed in Mexico the entire year. And that's just fact. You know, there's so few hunters going to Mexico relative to California or Arkansas or somewhere else. You know, since the 70s, no-till farming is where the pintails are going. Millions upon millions of eggs have been disked under or run over by equipment or something. When out there in the, you know, because those birds historically nested in short grass prairie, and most of that short grass prairie has been converted to agriculture. And it's no-till farming to hold the soil in place. So they choose, because they don't choose, but it's their option. They nest in last year's barley stubble or wheat stubble. and here comes the tractor to plant this year's crop. Mm-hmm. That's where your pintail are going in the Continental 48.
What?
You know what I'm saying? So I support Delta waterfowl. You know, and I've talked to a gentleman. He's a scalp biologist. He doesn't practice it right now. He does something else. But in the past, he worked for Al Apton. He'd run some of the scalp banding studies. He wrote his thesis on scalp productivity. And this blew my mind. I'm sitting in a duck blind in North Dakota, and I hear this conversation. What's wrong with scalp? Now, I'm in the deep south. Scalp is not our bread and butter bird. But get up north. Get up to those guys in North Dakota, Minnesota, Lee Chose, Wisconsin. I mean, man, blackheads, scalp are a big freaking deal to these guys. It's their bird, man. And it just blew my mind to hear this conversation. And what is wrong with this, Jeff, that the population of canvasbacks is 750,000, the limit's 2. The population of redheads is 2.5 million birds, the limit's 2. The population of scalp is 4.5 million freaking birds, the limit's 1.
Because of biologists.
What in the heck is going on? You go somewhere like Havre de Grace, Maryland, to hunt Susquehanna Flats or the Chesapeake Bay, and there's bazillions of scalp out there on the water, but the limit's 1. And you talk to some of these old timers about body booting, and they remember when they were young, and they were the muscle setting up the big body booting spread for the old timers today. Now they're the old timers, and there's no duck hunters coming behind them. There's no young people coming behind them to help set them up because the limit on scalp is 1. Yeah.
Why is that? What's the reasoning, do they say?
Who knows?
I don't know shit about scalp or however you say it, so we don't shoot very many of them here. I do think that pintails, we need to quit shooting hens. I think that they need to just not let you shoot hens. I'm good with 2 or 3 pintails. I think that's a great idea. But I would take the pintail hemet to – I would take the hen to 0. Now, that hurts as an outfitter because you get some guys that come in a flock that can't pick out a fucking white from a brown.
You can't do that.
Why?
There's no way. It would never – I would never call the shot on a fucking group of pintails if we couldn't shoot a hen. There's no fucking way.
If you can,
not in a million years would I call the shot on that.
I agree. You got to have a mulligan, Jeff, because they're just imperfect days and imperfect hunters, and the sun gets in your eyes, and the birds flying left to right or right to left, or it's cloudy, it's foggy. It happens.
Yeah.
It just happens.
I had a guy one time.
I mean, shit, a north wind day, you wouldn't be able to pick out anything. The sun's right in your eyes.
Well, I had a guy one time, and we were shooting. It was our one limit spec, and we could shoot 4 Canadas if you shot a spec. And this guy asked me, and this is no shit. He goes, "Could you sit up here in front of me and point out which ones are speckle bellies, which ones are Canada geese? One of them's got fucking orange legs, and one's got black legs. How fucking hard is that?
Your eyes are better than mine some days."
I just like, what the fuck?
Sit out here and point it out to me before I pull the trigger.
If you can't pick that out, you think I'm sitting in front of your ass while you got a gun? You've lost your damn mind.
I don't, you know, Jeff, I've asked the same question to some people a lot smarter than me about the duck population. I've wondered, you know, because there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. I have confidence in the duck numbers. I really, truly do. I have confidence in the people that are doing the best they can to count these ducks. But I do wonder if we don't need to reexamine things like bag limits and hunting days and things of that nature. I just wonder if we need to. You know, it's possible that we need to do that. You know, and that's what I'm trying to say. I've got faith in the system, and. But I just wonder if at any time, like, you know, for example, mallard ducks, a lot of the governance or a lot of the determination of how bag limits and days and quotas, let's call it, for scalp, for redheads, for pintails, is predicated on mallard ducks. Well, you know, there's only one mallard duck. Maybe there needs to be a lot more money dumped into the system to figure out models for redheads and scalp and canvasbacks. We got a higher statistical quota or quotient, you know, going into that. I mean, you know, you can't govern all these species of ducks over mallard. There needs to be some allowance for divers and different life habits and population dynamics and everything else. Hey, you know, one of the coolest things, get this, this blew my mind. We go out there to band some ducks right about the time that front was hit, and a couple of days before that front hit with a guy. And one of the traps he had, or two of the traps he had, was slap full of ringnecks. Slap full. It was 100 and, I don't know, let's say 110 wood ringnecks in these two traps. Two hens. The day before, they caught 100 ringnecks in the same two traps, and there were zero hens. That's 1% hen.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of horny ducks.
How is that even possible? Why is that? You know, and this is a very smart waterfowl ecologist. We're sitting there talking to him later in the evening, and he said something. He just wondered out loud, has the carrying capacity for hens been met? And it had never occurred to me that, you know, males and females have different life cycle requirements. Mm-hmm. They have different needs. Is it possible that the reason there's so few females, I mean, in addition to predation or whatever have you, you know, is it possible that the carrying capacity for hens has been exceeded, that it's level? And that's why there's not as many hens. I mean, because something's going on with ringneck. And I know that's a mighty small sample size, two catch nights, 200 ringnecks. But it's just kind of shocking that there were only two hens out of 200-something ringnecks.
Now, golden eyes, and I believe it's a golden eye. It's a Yankee bird, and I can't remember which one it is. I think it's a golden eye. The males or the females, one of them migrates. 90% of them or something migrate a month before the other one does. And I think it's going to be the Drake Goldeneye leaves Canada 30 days before the female does. I'm wondering if ringnecks, if the females don't go back before the Drakes do.
I don't believe so. These two catch nights happened right about the time the ship was hitting the fan with that big major cold front we're talking about.
Yeah, they wouldn't have been there. I don't know. That's crazy to think the numbers would be that skewed, though. That's amazing.
It ought to be looked at. It ought to be looked at, you know. And I know shooting bluebills down in Mexico, very few hens. Very few hens relative to drakes, you know. I don't know, Jeff. I don't know. It's some real interesting times.
I wonder what their long-term numbers are.
Waterfowl managers are in right now.
I wonder what the long-term numbers are for ringnecks.
I have no idea. A lot of people don't like to shoot them. I love them.
Fuck, they've saved many a bad hunts.
Yeah, they're fun to shoot.
Little bastards are fast. I just, I don't know, it's an interesting time that we find ourselves in right now, and I just worry about the future. I'm a young guy. I got kids, you know, I got young kids, and I know we're going to make the wrong move thinking we're making the right move just because that's how we are as humans, but something has to give, and we need to take a hard look at kind of the way that we've been operating the last 20 years.
They said the ringneck numbers are up, but the bluebill numbers are declining as ringneck numbers rise.
4.5 million bluebills.
Them poor damn hens, boy. Woof. They're getting wore the hell out.
Yeah. Yep. Interesting times we live in, but, you know, you got to go hunting.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right, but it's going to be interesting to see what gets.
This is interesting. In 1949, in Minnesota alone, they killed 559,000 bluebills. Last year, they killed 14,000.
Wow.
That's crazy.
I just think it's a bigger conversation that we need to have than whether or not to flood corn in central Illinois.
Right.
You know, and the last thing I'm going to say about flooded corn is this. There wouldn't be so goddamn many ducks going into it if they weren't finding some form of habitat value. So, and habitat value in and of itself, because there's so many ducks utilizing it, makes me a fan of it, whether you can kill them in there or not. You know, whether they're just going there because they're being overpressured or not, they're finding habitat value important, and ducks need good habitat value.
No, I'm not against them flooding anything. I just think it's kind of hypocritical on the other end of it. And
it's just weird where they draw the line as what
is baiting and what's not.
Yeah.
There's 3.6 million bluebills right now. That's more than there are gadwalls. So it's still ahead of the gadwalls. There's only 3.3 million gadwalls.
There you go. We shoot six of them.
And we don't see very many of them no more, or we haven't the last couple of years. But that see, there you go. You can shoot six of them, but you can only shoot one scup. That don't make sense, but the government doesn't make sense usually anyways. So tell me about – I want to talk to you about hunting in South America.
Oh, boy.
So what's the place to go for the guy that wants to go somewhere late spring or late summer here? Is there anywhere to go, or are they done by then?
Argentina. Argentina's open from mid-April through about mid-August, and it's a very long season. And most of the operators don't start opening. Our operators don't start opening until around May 1st. And that's when most of the clients want to travel. You know, it's sometime after the kids are out of school. June, July are the most popular dates because then the little league seasons are ending up. Family vacation's over. They can go out and sneak away for a week and shoot a bunch of ducks. And we do it. We, you know, years ago we used to work down in Argentina just under the standard quote booking agent unquote model, and we just kind of broke free of that 10 or 15 years ago to where we got off the grid, so to speak, and found the right operators. And boy, get choked to tell you about that place where my ashes will be scattered unless I find somewhere better, and I doubt I will. 130 square mile wetland marsh. It's the most amazing place. Now, it is evermore. You can't hardly get there from here. But it is the most wild and remote place I've ever been in my life, and you hunt by yourself in a blind, no bait, with a guide, not a bird boy, that calls birds and works them. And it's just high species diversity. It's very high volume. And, you know, we run a lot of hunters through there, but 130 square mile marsh, hell, there's parts of that marsh you can't get to. You can't even drive around for 3 hours to get to it because there are no roads around it. And it's just, and I know from having been down there, there's birds in that marsh 12 months out of the year. Just, you know, it's interesting to me. There's no, there's a continental migration we understand here in the Northern Hemisphere. The birds, some of those geese you're talking about, those cacklers are starting up in the Arctic, the specks starting up in the Arctic, the snow geese starting up around Hudson Bay and migrating down to the Gulf Coast and back. You go down to places in the Southern Hemisphere, Africa, Argentina, Australia, New Zealand. There's no continental migration. The birds are just nomadic. I don't know how a bird knows that it rained 10 centimeters 500 miles away, but they do. We were down, the last time we were down in Australia, it was so dry in the Victoria province. We were hunting down in the South Australia province, and just I think the limit was 12 birds, and we were limiting daily. And I get up one morning, and my buddies are sitting around the table kind of talking quietly to themselves. And they said, well, mate, we're going to go out and try to shoot some ducks. It's not going to be good. We got to pick up and go this afternoon and go to Victoria. I go, what? They go, yeah, it rained. And I don't, what's 10 centimeters, 4 or 5 inches?
Don't ask me to lie.
We got to go. And I said, nah, mine, the duck, it was less than 30% the number of ducks. And we get up there to Victoria, and we get back in them again. How in the world did that duck know that it rained? And that's a lot of what you see down in Argentina. And that vast marsh we hunt, you know, birds are coming in to feed. They're coming in to molt. They're coming in to nest. They're coming in to eat. They're coming in to live. You know, and then they're going back out. Some of them are. And it's just amazing the flux of birds in and out of that marsh. I can remember one year shooting rosybills, which I love to shoot. I'm not going to say how many I shot that morning. It was a bunch. it was a bunch. And we were dialed. I was dialed in. And it was chip shots. And as we were coming out, there were a couple of birds. Now, this would have been late July, early August, which is their wintertime. And if we were coming out, we got off kind of in the river channel. And by river, I mean this is 20 foot wide, maybe the channel is. And I saw a duck with its head down swimming, you know, like a duck will hide and swim when it's crippled. Mm-hmm. And I was hollering for a cartucho, and they're like, no mas cartucho, no mas, bambino. It was a baby duck. And as I talked to the operator about it, he said that the rosybills had three hatches that year. It was so wet and so good. And so just think about that. That'd be like you going out to shoot a duck impoundment January, and they're being hatched year bird that can't even fly yet.
Right.
Because the co-productivity is so good. It's an amazing wetland. And again, even though we're shooting a lot of birds relative to the American limit, you just got to understand that continentally, it's very, very low hunting pressure down there. Very low hunting pressure, you know. And that's the distinction.
What about for a guy that's wanting to go on a hunt somewhere, not a big spender, what's the best bang for the buck that you've got for someone to go somewhere else to hunt?
Argentina.
That is the best bang for the buck?
Hands down, the best duck for the buck. The best, you know, most ducks for the bucks is going to be real Argentina. And you know, it's a big internet. Go find a hunt. But I know this is someone that I've been down in Argentina since 2001. When I go to Safari Club International, there's 30 Argentine duck hunting operations on that floor, and I don't represent a damn one of them. I've been to their lodges. I've been to their fields. I've shot their ducks. It's just relative to an average day in Louisiana, Mississippi, it's pretty dang good. Relative to what real Argentina duck hunting is, it's mediocre at best. And I always liken it to, just imagine if you were in Argentina watching Rich and Tone television, you know, and watching these hunts on the satellite that everybody's got now, and you decided you were going to book a trip to America, and instead of going to Stanfield Hunting Lodge or going somewhere great, you got talked into going and saving a few bucks and doing this and doing that and going to Northern Georgia. That's a few ducks, but it's not the best place. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The internet's a real big place. And that's what I feel like. You know, I've got two hunts down there that truly my number one hunt in the world is a place called Las Flores. It's baited. And because it's legal. And we call an app operator kind of tongue in cheek. And the thing about it is, he gets context. A lot of times when there's an English, when there's a language barrier, they don't get context. This outfitter gets context. We call him the master baiter of the universe. He gets, and he wears it like a badge of honor. I was in SCI the last time they had convention, February 2020. And a lot of those Argentines that we don't work with will come buzz around the booth. And, buddy, Lord help you, Andy, if you're in my booth and we're talking, you're ready to go, and one of them guys walk up, I ain't going to let you go. I'm just going to keep on talking to you till they buzz off. I don't want to work with them. And I get on an elevator, and that night, the show was done, and I step on the elevator, and it's like a crowded elevator, so I'm sitting here just looking at the front of the elevator, and there's all these people behind me, and right when the door started to shut, this sumbuck crowds his way in. Now, he's sitting right next to me in a full elevator, and he starts in on me, blah, 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 and I indulge him. You don't bait. And boy... He got that finger going, all indignant, loud. Never, I mean, I'm embarrassed because all these people in the crowded elevator looking at it. He's carrying on like, "See, senor, I bait, I put out, I bait." I'm like, "No, you don't, man. You know, dumping corn in front of a blind every 8 to 10 days when your clients go out there and shoot them is not baiting." You know, he said to me something like, "I put out 5 tons of corn." He's yelling, "5 tons of corn annually he puts out." And I said, "My operator is putting out 1.5 tons of corn daily. 1.5 tons of corn daily in front of 40 blinds. That's and shooting them every 5 to 8 days or something." You know, and I know it makes people uncomfortable talking about the subject of baiting here in America, where it's prohibited, and there's a reason it's prohibited. But down there, it's not. And not only is this place baited, though, he don't let you go in there and lollygag around till 11 o'clock or noon. Now we're talking that temporal space. This man is baiting, putting out 200 pounds of corn in front of a blind every single day for 4 months, and he wants you in and out. You know, and if it's light enough for me to see with my naked eye at 7:30 in the morning, at 8:30 in the morning, I'm sitting on the tailgate of a truck, and me and you got our limits, which is 50 ducks per morning.
True.
It's fast and furious. The afternoons is 15. And we leave at 3 o'clock, drive 15 to 20 minutes to the blind, and usually by 4:30, 4:45, we're sitting on the back porch drinking cold beer, watching the sun go down with our 15 ducks hanging. And it's just a real fun. It's like going, just imagine going to Disneyland. I mean, it's like the Disneyland of duck hunts. I've done it a bunch. My clients love it. It's convenient. You don't have to. I had a 92-year-old client one time. And I don't mean one of these young 92-year-olds. This guy was in World War II in Korea. He was 92 years old. And the last hunt on face of earth he ever went to was that hunt. And it was a bad year. It was flooded, you know, and it took a lot of work. But they got him in there comfortably to where he could enjoy the hunting. And it's just that kind of place. And to the complete opposite end of the spectrum is that first place I was talking about. 130 square mile marsh. It's wild. It's pure. It's the coolest place I've ever set foot. You know, the very first morning I hunted there was about 9 years ago. And one of the ladies we hired down in Argentina 10 years ago had kept telling me about this place, and I wasn't interested. It was too far to go. Well, we went down there to scout. We were just bouncing around, and we ended up there. And the first morning, I walked in ankle-deep marsh not quite a half mile, but a long ways. And we stopped and threw out a few decoys. And throughout the morning, that bird boy was tugging on me and pointing to ducks. And I left with a bunch of ducks, 70 ducks I shot that morning. But I never will forget just stopping, and as far as I could see, it looked like parts of the Louisiana marsh. And there were ducks in all directions. And I realized in that moment, that first day, number one, I wanted my ashes scattered in this marsh, and number two, that I had walked a million miles through similar habitat throughout that country looking for this place. And I realized how special it was. But I told that outfitter, it's about a 10-hour ride if you drive in a van from Buenos Aires. It's about a 10-hour ride. Yeah. Unless it's, you know, in the last 52 kilometers is a dirt road. Unless it's been raining, then it's mud. Boy, I was choking them about it. It took us hours to get down that last 52 kilometers. And there were two trucks, and one truck drank a whole bottle of whiskey before we got to camp, just on that last 52 kilometers of four-wheel drive mud riding. And but once you're there, you're 5 or 10 minutes from the blind. And I told that operator the first time, I said, I love this hunt. I want my ashes scattered in this marsh. I won't sell any hunts. He goes, why? I said, it's too far a drive. Folks ain't going to do it. And sure enough, a lot of people just cannot be inconvenienced on vacation to make that drive. I'm sitting in Brandon, Mississippi. It'd be like driving to Dallas and back. Mm-hmm. The roads are muddy, in a day. But once I'm there, there's nowhere else in the world, let alone Argentina, that such habitat exists. It's not even like going to a place. It's like going to a time. It's like driving. It's like I get into a time machine, and 10 hours later, I wake up in the 1800s. That's what it means to me, and we're practically sold out. We stay sold out down there. Clients are kind of caught on. People don't even call up. They don't even know the name. They say, I want to go to that wild place you got. But Argentina, and their seasons are exactly, just the whole southern hemisphere, their seasons are exactly 6 months behind us. And August, September, October, November, December, January, February. August is like February down here. You know, July is like January. It's our peak winter.
Yeah. I want to go back to the duck numbers real quick. Do you think some of the problem could be that the reason guys are not seeing the ducks, like Jeff, that thinks now all of a sudden the numbers are skewed? You think it's because of the pressure? You think it's because they're hiding?
I think it is. That's my humble opinion. I think the ducks are patterning hunting activities. That's just my humble opinion.
Sure.
You know, now obviously, when you have a warm winter, the bulk of the migration is not coming down. They don't have to. There's plenty of habitat up north. But yeah, I believe that, Andy. I believe that. I think they're sitting in those cornfields or those thickets or wherever they can get away from hunters until the sun goes down. They can come out and feed without getting shot. That's what I think.
Is that the traveling decoy you got beside you?
Yeah. Look at that. You see that on the internet this year?
Yeah, I saw that. Is there anywhere you can sign on it anymore, or is it all filled up?
You have to start signing over names. You know, there's a story, but I got asked by a lot of people about this decoy. And it's just an old herder's decoy, and it's really a lousy choice to sign on and a lousy choice to I had thought when I was going to do this travel decoy around all these people I hunted with, I probably hunted 120, 130 days or times between mid-September and end of January, end of February. But I had thought that I would float it everywhere I went. And that's a lousy decoy to do it, because you remember the old herder foam decoys, they lose their paint, they lose their scratch real easy. And but I'll tell y'all about this. You know, I feel very strongly. You know, so a lot of people say, well, why did you, what's the point? Why are you getting everybody to sign it? Well, you know, next time we do a meeting, I'll go to my game room over at camp and just show y'all some of the background there. But I just found over the years, you know, I don't collect birds, but I do have a lot of mounted birds. And I noticed every time I started telling a story about that barheaded goose, about that snow goose, about that red-crested poacher, about that pintail, about that gargany, about whatever, anytime I started telling a story about that bird and about that hunt, it always came around to people. And that was what was so amazing to me this hunting season, was traveling around hunting, was hunting with these people. And many, many, many people that shared their part of the world and their slice of the pie and their stories. And I just really found a tremendous amount of value in doing that. So now I'll hang this decoy. Next time I go to camp, I'll hang it up in my game room. And it'll be just a tribute to all these many people I hunted with.
It's damn interesting.
I'll tell you why that's important, Jeff, is this decoy belonged to a friend and a client of mine. And I know that because of the way it was rigged with this screw in the bottom. Most of his other decoys had his name on the bottom. This one doesn't. But I know the way he wrapped this, put this wood screw in that foam, that was his. And I'd forgotten about it. And I'd taken it to camp and put it up on a shelf. And I went to go get an old wooden black duck decoy I had. Probably use it next year. And this decoy was right next to it. And I took it down. I looked at it and I remembered. And I'm going to tell you, the man's life, he was the kind of guy. We travel. There were mornings I would wake up after him carrying on the night before telling stories and jokes. I would wake up and my stomach hurt like I had done crunches from laughing so hard the night before. He was that guy. He brought out the best in people. He was just a very, very generous and giving man. And he called me up one day out of blue and said, hey, I'm cleaning out the garage. You want some decoys? I said, yeah, what you got? He said, I got a bunch of these old herder decoys, burlapped and some, you know, just got a big sack of them. Man, it's a massive sack of them. About a year or two later, his life ended in tragedy. And, you know, because we all got demons and that we have to deal with. And as I walk by my game room and I see a picture of him, he and I hunt together. I think about that, and I think to myself, I shared the best times or some of the best times of that man's life with him in a duck blind. And that's kind of gets back to the point of why I wanted to, as I'm meeting people around the country and around the world, to have them sign it, you know, and it's just immoral, because I really do treasure the times and the people and the stories. You know, a lot of people would ask, well, golly, man, you know, it just blows my mind. So many people were asking, how in the world did you meet all these people? And it's like you've known them your whole life. You step into a duck blind, you shake hands, you've never met them, but it's like y'all are family. And I said, man, that's just because we're all duck hunters.
Yep, special bond.
You know, it don't matter how a man acts on Facebook. You meet him face to face in a duck blind, and in that moment, you're just duck hunters.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, I think, and I think that's something that separates waterfowl hunting from any other kind of hunting, because you get that opportunity to bond in the duck blind. You don't get that in a deer stand. You don't get it, you know, you don't get it anywhere else. It's an exclusive thing to waterfowl hunting. And that's why some of the bonds that, you know, we formed in the field and even through this podcast, I mean, you know, there are people that we might not align with politically or socially or anything like that, but if we get them on this podcast or if we see them out in the field, just like you said, they're just duck hunters, and we just want to hear their story.
Best conversations in the world are that 15 minutes before legal shooting time, and it goes from the greatest stories in the world to tell Jeff to shut the fuck up. It's about time to shoot. But yeah. that well, is what happens.
Ducks, in general, you think about it. If you took the average duck hunt, the best duck hunt, 30 minutes, six guys.
Yeah.
You know, the trigger pulled, if you added up put a timer on the trigger pulled, it's just seconds.
Yeah.
It's moments. Yeah. In an hour and a half hunt, let alone a hunt till lunch. And, you know, I've always felt that the time between the volleys is where real duck hunting and real life happens. You know, the conversations, I can remember when my sons were graduating high school, especially this day and age, man, they got football, they got this, they got a cell phone, they got girls. But, man, when you're in a duck blind, you talk about things, you just ain't going to talk about the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's still, man, doesn't it feel good to go to somewhere it is politically incorrect as a duck blind or a goose blind? Doesn't it feel good that there's still somewhere like that in the world that you can just let your hair down and say what you want to say?
Yeah. I'm in my element there.
I am in my element, yeah.
I can remember. I
criticize me all the time coming back from, you know, being gone 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 5 weeks, a month, whatever. My language is just, whew, it's pretty bad, man. It made Red Fox blush.
Mine is, too. That's funny that your wife says that, because my wife says the same thing. Like, she made a comment not too long ago. Like, yeah. Man, last summer you were doing real good, but now you're just kind of like a sailor. I'm like, well, shit, it's just who I've been around. But you mentioned that. I can remember a couple years ago I had a father and a son, and it was just them two. And they were duck hunting. And same like you said, he was in football, baseball, wrestling, track. I mean, just his calendar was full, the son's was. And he was a senior in high school. And I remember that dad telling me after that hunt was over that they talked more on that 2 days of hunting and being out here at the lodge than they had almost his entire high school career. Felt like he re-met his son. Just in the time being out here. I mean, life's busy. You get shit. It's hard. It's hard to parse out, you know, 30 minutes of your day if you got a wife and two kids of one-on-one action. And he did. He said, I feel like I've talked to my son more this weekend than I have in his whole high school career.
I guarantee you did. You know, and I mean, look, nobody I know, not one person listening, goes duck hunting and goes through all this stuff to watch a sunrise. I mean, yeah. I can do that on my front porch right now. We're out there to shoot waterfowl. I get it.
That's right.
But I mean, seriously, is it just me? Am I just so damn old? Because when I think back to any hunt I had this year, the story always goes back to the people or to what we talked about and where we hunted. It the ducks are just a small part. I can't remember how many ducks I shot on any given morning. I can remember certain ducks. Like I tell you, one of the craziest thing, we were talking about pintail earlier. I was out in the Central Valley of California with John Wills. We were sitting in a pit blind, and I didn't feel it, man. It was 9 o'clock before we got there. We tried something else that morning, and the way the decoys were set up, I just didn't feel it. And bam, bam, right off the bat, we both get our pintail. I'm like, well, that's great. We didn't get skunked. There was a bazillion pintail floating around in rice checks. And, well, there directly we shot a pair of mallards, shot a trio of widgeons, and first one thing another, well, it climbed on up to about noon. He said, man, you ready to go get a lunch burrito? I ate burritos for whatever day, 14 days straight, and they were excellent. But but I was sitting on six ducks at this point. I'm like, well, John, I kind of hate to leave. I kind of hate to leave a duck on the table, you know. And a bald eagle flew over the far side of the field, and, man, did the pintails get up? I bet 1,500, 2,000 pintails from 30 yards to the left on my side, to 30 yards on the right on his side, and 30, 35 yards, thousands of pintails started streaming over. We're done on pintails. So I'm looking, pintail, 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 shoveler, bam. Duck number 7 was a shoveler. And I thought, boy, right by the time you think you've seen it, done it all, you pass on 1,500 pintails to kill a bootlip. You know? But, you know, you get, it's all about that limit sometimes, even to me. But I can remember so many things that happened that morning that John and I talked about. I can remember a phone call we got. I can remember so much about it beyond just the number of ducks.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I heard y'all talking to Chokes the other day. I'll ask y'all, instead of saying, wouldn't you agree that nearly everybody listening would value a quality hunt over a quantity hunt? Quality hunt?
No, but I would. But a lot of people don't. A lot of people, it's about blind. Ducks.
Young kids.
Ducks are a religion. Ducks are the religion and the blind is the church.
Yeah.
And that's why we do it.
But back to what you said, though, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think if you rewind the clock a couple years, most people would rather have a quality over quantity. But the way Instagram is, baby, you got to get Instagram famous, and it's all about the quantity. So
I think that's some people, though, Andy. I don't think people body. I've got way too many friends and way too many clients that are just over the numbers. I hunted 4 flyaways, 20 states, all them hundreds of people I hunted with. Wasn't nobody mad at them.
Yeah.
Wasn't nobody mad. One of the coolest hunts I did out in California, we went and shot geese with the White Brothers. And I was talking to Jonathan on the way out the night before. He's like, no, we won't shoot a limit. I go, what, the geese? No, we're going to see plenty of geese. We can shoot a limit of snows and aleutians, but we're just not going to do that because, you know, the geese we're going to see tomorrow are the geese we're going to hunt all season. There's 20,000 geese around. They said that's all we got. Mm-hmm. And they play the highest A-est game, A game, the highest game of goose hunting I've ever seen. And we shot plenty of them. Let me tell you, we shot plenty of them. But when the big mobs come in, they would let those 2,000 land 15 yards away and walk off and walk further away from us. And then wait on another play where you had just 5 or 10, or, you know, so birds come in that we can make those numbers and not educate the mass flocks. And so on the one hand, it was the highest quality hunt I can remember. I can't tell you how many we shot. We shot a pile of them, but not a bunch. You know, not a limit, far from a limit. But it was the highest quality hunt for that many ducks and geese, or excuse me, geese, aleutians and snows to be landing in your lap. Mm-hmm. All morning long, it was one of the highest quality hunts I've ever been on, and the numbers became irrelevant. We could have shot 120 geese. What the hell are we going to do with 120 geese? You know? But we didn't. We shot plenty.
That's right. And I wish more people had that mentality. We saw that a little bit this year with just because COVID kept so many people in the homes. People were excited to be out of the house. So absolutely, we did see a more appreciative bunch of guys out here, and I don't know. Yeah, but you know, you're right. I think it's the majority of the hunters out there. The guys that are going to be doing this for the long term, the guys that are going to be doing this 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they would take a quality hunt over a quantity hunt. It's a guy that he'll be out of here in another 2 years. First time he gets his teeth kicked in on a regular basis, he'll be out of here. That's the guy that's all about numbers right now.
Well, if you're all about numbers, you're in for a world of disappointment with all the topics we covered tonight, don't you think?
I think so. They probably turned it off a long time ago.
They probably did.
Well, Ramsey, we appreciate your time, my friend. Where are you going to next?
South Africa.
Ooh.
Well, let me say this. Let me preface this. Right now, Argentina is closed. Don't ask me why, but they're closed. Liberal government, similar to, say, California. They're closed. They're struggling to get their vaccinations out to the people. We had thought they would open. They have not. We've heard they might open in April. That remains to be seen. They're closed. We can't go. So if they open at any time between now and August this year, Double R will be heading that way pronto. I'm scheduled to be down there from April 22nd. That ain't happening until about the 4th of July. But in late August, we've got we did not get to go last year. We've got a hunt scheduled for South Africa. And I tell you, COVID just got in the way. But, you know, you got Mexico, you got Argentina. And of all the places I've hunted in the world for the guys that just love the taxidermy, for guys that love volume, for guys that love adventure, man, Africa's right there with it. You know, that to me represents one of the top three hunts in the world outside the United States would be Africa, Argentina, and Mexico. Not necessarily in that order, but those three are the three crown jewels.
Is Africa, what's the logistics on the travel for that? Is this not very bad?
It's a real long flight. You know, from Atlanta, I believe it's about 14 hours to Joburg. It's a long flight. But other than that, it's not bad. We get there, the time's all wonky. So we'll stay in a bed and breakfast that night, get up the next morning, and catch up with the outfitter and start hunting. And the hunt we actually do is it took a long time to thread this hunt together. But I've got two outfitters, both in South Africa, one in Mpumalanga province, one in Zululand. And we'll book a hunt to either lodge, but the granddaddy hunt is, say, go 3 or 4 days to each one because of species diversity and different hunting terrain and hunting opportunities, upland and geese and ducks. And it's just a huge adventure. And, you know, we worked with Jake Latondres. We filmed it last time we were down there, and it's going to make an epic episode, a little video we put together for it.
Well, you need to be safe down there and watch your step. We're going to get out of here. We're fixing to have a thunderstorm hit us. We need the rain.
Thank y'all. I enjoyed it.
Appreciate Thank you for coming on.
Rams, appreciate it, bud. God bless you, and have a great, great, great summer, bud.
You too. Thank y'all. Uh-huh.
Be safe, bud.
Bye. Most interesting man in America.
That's it. Him and Lee, and they're all cut from the same cloth.
You think when they get off here, they ever say, well, that Andy, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, most of the time.
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
We got Mr. Wyman Menzer will be on with us tomorrow.
It's scheduled, so speak freely.
Last year we had a power outage.
Oh, fuck, and we got a thunderstorm coming now.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll be out here by then, or it won't be nothing like that. They did have a funnel at Paducah, I just saw.
Well, you missed a good chase day, Jeff.
No, I didn't. No. Not at all. All right, thank y'all for listening to us. God bless y'all. We got a new shirt up. It's on the page. Check it out. It's the tornado shirt. The what's it say on it? I forgot already.
Tornado warning.
Tornado warning's got the geese coming in. Big Honker Podcast. Appreciate it. God bless y'all.
Go check out all of our sponsors. Check out Blind Grass. They're not just a grass company. They've also got gun totes. What the fuck am I trying to say? Long episode. They got waterproof shell bags. The works. Pacific Calls, Gundog Outdoors, Goose Creek, Bangtail Whiskey, Stanfield Hunting Outfitters, Dive Bomb Industries, Boss Shot Shells, Dirty Duck Coffee, Lucky Duck, and the Looking Glass Duck Club.